All
It
right.
takes the village to remind us to start the
Yes,
recording.
thank you. I have a calendar reminder that for some reason never actually pops up at the top one, so I will figure
Yeah.
something else out.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so first item, approve the September minutes. Any edits or corrections to September CSCC minutes? Okay, that means we have a consensus support for approving September minutes. Marshall and Miranda, can you move to approve the September minutes?
Yeah, I move to approve the September meeting minutes from the Complete Streets Coordinating Council.
And I second.
Awesome. Brian will now review the agenda.
Hey, everybody. Our traffic engineer Hal Feldman is going to be giving a presentation on traffic signals. It's a traffic signals 101, so it's kind of like a kind of the basics, just sort of intended to be in the vein of the crossings presentation that Blake Olufsen gave a few months back, just sort of a primer on traffic signals, the components of them, how we use them, different safety aspects of them. I'll be giving a couple of updates on projects. One of them is a project that was done under the small dollar projects authorization at Helen and Mountain, and I'll also be giving an update on the recently completed Silver Bell safety improvements that the CSCC approved in March. Those are the presentations. We have an expanded time to discuss the personal complete streets experiential opportunity this month, so we always seem to run out of time for that, so we've allowed a little more space for that and some discussion at the end.
Excellent. A few of you haven't, if you wouldn't mind, Sophie, Ward 6 Council Office, and Michelle, we put an S in front of your name if you're staff, an O if you're an observer. Members have an M. If you can click on the rename to do that, it's in the three dots on your icon. That would be helpful. And then put your full name if your name isn't there. The call to the audience, sounds like Chris is wanting to talk with us as call to the audience. Anybody else wanting to speak during call to the audience? You can raise your hand. Okay, so I think we've read this all before when Chris was making the comments. The limit is 3 minutes. It may not result in discussion with members of the CSCC, although CSCC members may decide to agendize it in a future meeting. No legal action may take place during the call. Speakers may not be disruptive. Members may only respond to criticism. And members of the audience may still participate in agendized items as noted before, as per the bylaws of the CSCC. So, Chris,
Yes. Thank you.
you're on.
And hi, everybody. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Chris Lopez. I'm representing Julia Keene Neighborhood Association. I have already explained, the situation that we're concerned with on Country Club between Aviation and 22nd Street. On August 28th, Patrick and Ryan were very nice to give us a meeting and listen to our concerns. I believe that, of course, Ryan has given you all the information, but my question now, of course, I know you can't answer me, but the coming weeks in the memo that we got, the email that we got, that there was going to be some safety provisions that were going to be done in the, really quickly, like in September or October, and there was going to be action being taken. And then, of course, there was a longer term. So I'm just trying to figure out here, when is this actually going to get started? There was going to be some easy provisions, immediate steps, like for the speed signs, evaluate the speed limits, making some minor improvements that can be made right now. So that is my concern because I haven't seen anything being done yet. So I just wondering, when it was going to get started. Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much, Chris. And I imagine, Ryan, you could probably get back to her to answer that question.
Yeah, I can do that. I can also mention it in the like the project updates at the end of the meeting as well. I mean, it'll be pretty brief, but I can address it there. But I can also, yeah, Chris, I can shoot you an email just to give you an update of what's going on.
That's fine. Yeah, then I can share it with everyone.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. All right. Thank you, Chris. Anyone else? Audience members? Okay. Now we'll go to our exciting presentation on Traffic Signals 101. Hal, take it away.
Okay, here we go. Can you all see my screen?
Yes.
Okay. So like Ryan said previously, I wanted to give you a high level overview of traffic signals, the components, how they operate, that sort of thing. And as I understand it, smart mobility is supposed to be giving you a presentation in the near future about what their projects, what their safety projects, and what they're working on. So I kind of wanted to meld this one, and so it would flow right into a future one that smart mobility gives you. So talking about traffic signals, I get the question all the time. Well, go install a traffic signal at a certain intersection. What the real first step is an intersection has to meet signal warrants. And signal warrants are found in the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, the MUTCD. That's basically what traffic engineering follows for guidelines on signals, signing, striping, all the traffic-related items out on the roadways. And the MUTCD outlines 9 warrants for the justification of a traffic signal. And those justifications or factors include traffic and pedestrian volumes, school traffic, if it's part of a coordinated signal system, crash history at a location, if it's near a railroad crossing. So if an intersection, after this, a warrant study, meets one of those 9 warrants, it could be eligible for a traffic signal. And that's why, you know, a lot of times we get a call that, you know, install a signal at a particular location. If it doesn't warrant a warrant, one of the warrants, we are not going to install a traffic signal at that location. One of the factors for that is, you know, the current price of a traffic signal is between $400,000 and $700,000 based on the complexity of the intersection. So just for that piece of information. The other thing is when we talk about traffic signals, the types, you know, we could be talking about regular traffic signals at an intersection. We could be talking about pedestrian hybrid beacons, AKA HOCs, out on the streets. We could be talking about emergency vehicle signals. And in the city of Tucson, we are maintaining approximately 420 traffic signals and 150 HOCs, just to give you an idea of the scope or the magnitude of the infrastructure. I wanted, because I'm going to be throwing out different terms, and so that we're all on the same base here, I wanted to just give a little picture of an intersection and kind of highlight the various components of a traffic signal, from a signal cabinet to signal heads, vehicle detection, the PED infrastructure. And the signal pole is typically the vertical pole on the mast arm assembly, and the mast arm is the horizontal part that's usually holding the overhead signal heads. And if we're going along, if you have a question, holler at me. Part of the components of traffic signal operation is the signal timing, the timing of the signal. And so I wanted to go over a couple of basic terms with you so that we're all on the same path here.
Kel,
Yes.
Marshall has his hand up.
Oh, I'm not. I've got
Don't worry, I'll call on them. I'll go
okay,
to them. You
awesome.
don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, I just asked a quick question, Hal. You said 420 signals or 450. What was that?
It
Is that like
was 420
420?
signals and 150 hawks.
Is that 420? Is that like total in the city, or is that like at like total intersections?
Though that's the total number of traffic signals within the city.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Thanks.
Okay. So as we're talking about a signal phase, what we're talking about is a phase is basically a direction of traffic. So at an intersection, if the northbound through movement, that is a phase. If the adjoining left turns, if there's one lane or two left turn lanes, that's a separate phase. So it's the direction of a traffic movement, basically. Clearance period. That is the yellow and all red time, which follows the green ball of the phase. The clearance period is timed or calculated, the yellow and all red times are based on the geometrics of that intersection. So the width of the intersection, the speed of the approaching traffic, all those terms come into play when we're calculating the yellow and all red time at a signal. Just as a note, the yellow and all red time can vary from intersection to intersection because of the geometrics of those varying intersections. But each one is calculated independently for each intersection. And then the last key signal timing term is cycle length. Cycle length is the amount of time it takes to serve all of the phases and the clearance periods at a particular intersection. So, typically cycle length doesn't mean much to the average person, but a typical cycle length in the city of Tucson is 108 seconds. So, in 108 seconds, we serve all the through movements and all the left turns at a particular intersection. And as I stated earlier, about this presentation tying into a future smart mobility one, these slides that I'm starting here, when I've put them at the comments down in the lower part of the slide in green, these are the benefits that smart mobility have identified to make improvements with using the Prop 411 funding. So that's how I'm tying our Signals 101 presentation into what you will be hearing about in the future. So the first component is underground components. Like we saw in that previous slide, there's a lot of signal equipment that's above the ground, signal cabinets, signal poles, that sort of thing. There is just as much equipment below the intersection or below the surface. And that is basically that's running the signal. So we've got conduits and wires in those conduits that are running from the signal cabinet on the corner to each of the signal poles, on all the other corners. The safety benefits of improving those is, some of these signals are 30, 40, 50 years old. So there's old wiring, underground that can lead to signal outages. And the other thing is conduits. Older conduits tend to be a little smaller. They could be broken, damaged, clogged, and that prevents new wires from being pulled into the conduits for new tech that c becomes available over the years. So that's the underground part. Let's see, signal cabinet, as I mentioned earlier. On one of the corners, there's going to be a metal box. And that's what controls or contains all of the electronic devices to operate that traffic signal. There's controllers, there's units in there that actually monitor the controller to make sure it's working correctly. It's where all the underground field wiring comes into that cabinet to be tied into the signal controller, so that times can be relayed out to the field, how long the green is, how long the yellow is, that sort of thing. So and like everything else, signal cabinets have a lifespan. And so the b benefit of upgrading signal cabinets is, they are in a harsh environment. So there's improved weather resistance. And just like everything else, there's always technology coming in the future. So newer cabinets can accommodate newer devices. Let's see. Signal heads. This is probably the most seen, one of the most seen items or components to a signal. They are mounted on the signal poles or the mast arms, and it's basically telling the driver, how to proceed through the intersection. Signal heads can be made of aluminum or plastic materials, and the indications, those red, yellow, green indications you see, are LED indications. This is another safety benefit, is that newer signal heads, better indications help drivers make better decisions. So it's worthwhile upgrading those signal heads. Vehicle detection. This is a big item in traffic signal operations. Basically, detection tells the signal when there's a vehicle waiting to be served. This is the eyes of the traffic signal. And the systems are used to gather this information and feed it into the signal controller. Key component is a lot of times we're asked in traffic engineering, can I get the video from that detection system? Images are not stored or recorded. And the last big part of detection is non-working detection results in inefficient signal operations. I'll give you a perfect example. You come up to a traffic signal and you get a red light, and the side street gets a green light, and there's no vehicles there. Chances are that is bad detection. Because what happens is the fail-safe status of vehicle detection. For example, if the video camera is has sun glare, or it's been hit by lightning, or it's just not working, what happens if a detector's not working fail-safe? It'll put a call, or it will say to the controller, "There is someone there. Serve that phase or that direction." So it's safe in that if there is or not someone waiting there, it'll get served. But if there's no one there, we're wasting time on the main street when we could be moving cars on the main street and serving that side street with no one there. So this one has a huge safety benefit of better signal operation. And upgraded detection enables, it's called Automatic Traffic Signal Performance Measures, ATSPM. It's basically gives metrics of how the signal is operating. Are we clearing all the cars on the side street, for example, that sort of thing. So good detection gives us lots of data, which we can use. So that has a huge benefit for upgrades. Pedestrians, this is a big topic. Pedestrian equipment consists of basically two main components. You've got the push button on the pole, and you've got the pedestrian signal head on the pole. And let me mention timing of pedestrians for a minute. And most everyone has seen, you know, when you're at the corner and you hit the push button and you're looking across the street at the ped head, and you're waiting for that walk light. So what the walk light is telling a pedestrian is when the walk light is activated, that is the time when the pedestrian can start moving off the sidewalk and crossing the street to the far side. So then after the walk light indication, the flashing don't walk starts. And that is basically to tell the person to finish their crossing to the far side. But if there's a person on that first sidewalk, don't start that cross. If it's already flashing, don't walk. And then it's followed by the steady don't walk that tells the pedestrian don't enter the roadway at this time. A lot of people ask how are the times calculated for this? So typically, and every intersection is different, but typically timing for the walk indication is 5 to 7 seconds based on the geometrics of the intersection. That's to get the person started walking. The flashing don't walk, that is calculated at the length of that crosswalk divided by 3.5 feet per second. So the average person is walking 3.5 feet every second. So we just take the distance divided by 3.5. That will generally tell us what the flashing don't walk time is. So those are some common things about timing of for the pedestrian part of it. Another big component, which I think has had a huge benefit to traffic signals over the last few years, is the countdown pedestrian signals. It's basically displaying the number of seconds remaining until that steady don't walk indication is going to be shown. So, and I think pedestrians in their gut understand it and figure it out. And so they can judge how they're doing in that crossing period, if they need to speed up or how they're doing and where they're at in the crosswalk before they're going to get that steady don't walk. Yes.
Brian, there's a question.
Okay.
Thank you. I didn't know if we were waiting for questions at the end or if we could.
No, we can do it throughout. Okay. Yes.
So the 3.5 feet per second thing.
Yes.
I just want to know more about that, because sometimes you see people who, I mean, obviously are not keeping pace with that,
right,
or maybe have a toddler in tow
mobility issues.
Mobility issues, a cart full of other things. You know, I mean, right. So. Seems to me that it should be longer than an average person to compensate for, you know, people who might get stranded midway.
Right. So, and as I said earlier about the MUTCD, and that's the federal guidelines that we follow, it's stated in there the 3.5 feet per second walking speed. So that's where we start at. And so that's how we'll initially time an intersection. If we get a call or a request to evaluate a crossing time, just like you said, from a person maybe who's has a mobility issue or has issues getting across the street in that allotted time, we can always add more time to that flashing don't walk period this is kind of I would say, the minimum time of the flashing to walk. So it can always be adjusted.
Okay. Yeah, it seems like that would be good to have it not the minimum, because it's not, only the not everyone can do that. But the other one is, I do hear from people, my wife in particular, like I don't know, when she's biking and crossing at the Hawk at this one's Treat and Speedway, that even on a bike it starts like flashing. So this is a little different. So it goes from the solid red to flashing red, and then people want to start driving through. And I,
Okay.
so that's a question about like how that's timed, but also, it's super long across Speedway. But also, if there is an issue like that, what is the reporting, or how do you reach out? What's the phone number or email that people should use if they're having trouble with the timing?
So, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ryan, but you can always call 311 for City of Tucson issues, and you can report issues through 311.
Yes, yeah, that's our clearinghouse,
Best
basically.
one.
Any kind of public works of any kind, whether it's streets, parks, anything, 311 will route you to the right person to get that looked into.
Okay.
And
And yeah.
I was
Yeah,
just
go
going to
ahead.
say, and to answer your question about the Hawks, you beat me to it. In a slide or
Oh,
two,
okay. That's
we're
fine.
going to talk about the operation of a Hawk signal, because that's a very common question also. So yes.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. So let's see, where were we? We were at safety benefits. Another I would say newer technology, which has a huge safety benefit for the pedestrians, it's called accessible pedestrian signals, or APS. And this will help pedestrians with visual and hearing impairments. It's basically, and you've probably been at a corner where you've heard the beeps or the audible tones, and they could also have verbal messages. So this is an improvement of technology that's come about. So this is a huge benefit for pedestrians. Let's see. Another big topic for comments is left turns. So left turns at a traffic signal can be operated basically in three manners. The left turn could be permissive, or it could be protective permissive, or it could be protected. And when I say that, what I mean is permissive is when you come up in the left turn bay and your signal indication is just a green ball. So you make that left turn when there's a appropriate gap in oncoming traffic. A protected permissive is basically you will get a left turn arrow, and there's a time in that left turn period where you could turn on the green ball. Or the third method of operating left turns is it's protected only. You can only make that left turn on the green arrow. So, you could see a left turn arrow either leading or lagging. And all that means is leading is it comes up at the beginning of the phase, or lagging, it ends at the or the left turn arrow comes up at the end of that phase. That's leading and lagging. Another big topic of discussion are the flashing yellow arrows. There's been lots of work of late of converting the standard, or what's been around forever, of those five section signal heads to these four section signal heads with the flashing yellow arrows. And I guess we could have a little discussion right here about the flashing yellow arrows. And it takes a fair amount of work. Sometimes it takes rewiring of the intersection. Sometimes it takes a longer mast arm to get that 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 left turn indication over the left turn bay, or where that left turn vehicle is waiting. That's stated in the MUTCD, because a lot of the older intersections with shorter mast arms, that old 5-section signal head's not really in that left turn bay. So there's physical improvements that need to be done at the intersection. But the benefit of and people ask, well, can't you just take down the old 5-section head and put up the 4-section head? And the answer is no, because the old 5-section signal head has a red ball. That red ball is tied to the same red balls that are indicating on that through lane that is right next to it, where this 4-section flashing yellow arrow is its own phase, its own left turn phase. So, and that's the safety benefit that smart mobility is working on, is what we can do with these flashing yellow arrow signal heads is we can have protected only phasing where you can only make that left turn on a green arrow by time of day. And that's one of the things that we're evaluating right now. We're starting with all of the dual left turn bays at the intersections. And we've started with the intersections that have dual lefts all four directions. We're evaluating, there's a city policy based on crashes, approaching speeds, those sort of factors. We're converting those dual lefts, if they meet the warrants, to that protected only. And we're starting with time of day. And when I say time of day, I mean 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. And so what we're attempting is those intersections that warrant for that flashing yellow arrow by time of day, we will evaluate after a year of that time of day operation. And if we're seeing those crashes still occurring in those off-peak times, then we could convert that intersection to protected only 24/7. So that's where we're sitting there. So that's my spiel on left turns. Next is preemption. Preemption is basically equipment that is in the signal cabinet, basically giving priority to an emergency vehicle that is approaching that signal. And when we're talking emergency vehicle, we're talking the fire trucks and the ambulances, the larger, heavier vehicles. And so the safety benefit is that it reduces the response times for emergency vehicles if they can get through that intersection without having to come to a complete stop. And it's a benefit to basically all the users, the road users in that intersection with that approaching emergency vehicle, that they know that they have the right of way to get that through that intersection.
Hal, there's a hand raised.
Okay.
Ariel?
I was curious with the priority to emergency vehicles, if that includes prioritizing it over pedestrian travel. And I asked because as an avid pedestrian, I've had more than once the light changes to favor an emergency vehicle that is crossing through the previously walk signal that I was trying to cross. So I was wondering how it takes into account what's happening with pedestrian traffic, if at all.
So that's a good question. That has been a topic of late on the national traffic signal scene, is preemption and pedestrian crossings. And there's basically two schools of thought in that when the emergency vehicle's coming through, does the pedestrian time get cut short so that the emergency vehicle can keep on going through? Or if the pedestrian crosswalk time, if there's a pedestrian, in that crosswalk, Do we finish out the appropriate crosswalk time, get the pedestrian out of the street, and then allow the emergency vehicle through the intersection? So there's been lots of discussion, and we, the city of Tucson, we have been going or trying to go with the do not shorten the crosswalk time and for the approaching fire truck. So,
Thank you.
okay. Here's another piece of equipment or component. It's basically the uninterrupted power supply, UPS. It's basically a battery system to keep the signal operating during power outages. Dark signals can lead to traffic congestion. It can lead to safety issues. So this is another benefit that smart mobility is wanting to use more often at signals. Basically, and power outages don't happen that often, but if you have a big intersection and no power, I'm sure we've all seen it where it's a traffic nightmare. So this is a huge benefit to keep everyone moving smoothly. And I'm so I've talked about signal components and a 1,000-foot overview of that. I wanted to just talk a minute about traffic signals are not one of those things that you build and walk away from. They take maintenance. And when I say they take maintenance, they take the electronics in the cabinet, the PED push buttons, the LED and signal head indications. There's crashes where there's a signal pole knocked down. There's old wiring leads to issues. Wind can knock those video detection units that are mounted up on the mast arm. They can knock those out of alignment, so they're not looking at the approach they're supposed to be. So that leads to the signal timing issues. So that's the routine maintenance part of it. And I skipped over my note about, let's go back for a second, about pedestrians. This is where, let's talk about the HOC operations. So City of Tucson has quite a few HOCs on the busy streets. And like the question was earlier about the displays of those HOCs. So it has a different signal head orientation in that there's two red balls on top and a yellow or amber light underneath those two red lights. So typically a HOC signal is dark, and it's dark until someone, a pedestrian, comes up and pushes the button. Then what happens is the amber yellow starts flashing. And the amber yellow is flashing, then it goes, the amber goes to a solid indication. And so the solid amber is followed by the steady red. Both red balls are solid. And what this, what when the two solid red lights are on, that is when the pedestrian gets their walk light. The next phase is those two red lights start flashing alternately. So this, when the HOC lights to the vehicles are flashing red, that is when the pedestrian is in their flashing don't walk mode. So the HOC indications to the drivers will remain flashing until that pedestrian countdown timer reaches zero and it times out. And then what happens is those two flashing red heads go to the dark mode again until the next pedestrian arrives. So what happens is, you know, it starts off with a flashing yellow on the street. That's to tell the driver, you know, something's about to change. And then when it goes solid yellow, that's typical of a solid yellow at a regular traffic signal, in that you've got to make that decision if you're going to stop or go. And then it's just the two solid red indications is the same as a solid red light of a traffic signal, that you're not permitted to cross that stop bar or that white line. And when the hawk indications for the drivers go to that alternating flashing red indication, what the driver, and I should say, is supposed to do is, if the driver comes up, stops at the white line, the hawk is indicating that flashing red lights. If the driver does not see a pedestrian in the crosswalk, then they can proceed through that crossing. If the driver comes up and during that flashing red, if there's someone in that crosswalk, that driver is supposed to, I say supposed to, stay stopped until the pedestrian clears the roadway. So I hope that answers your question about the operation of the signal, or we can talk about that some more.
There is another question by Marshall, okay, and then Ariel, and then Riley.
Okay.
Yeah, my question was on the previous slide about the UPSs. Do you know how many of the traffic intersections have those, and how long? I guess with the LED lights, the UPSs can actually last for quite a while.
Correct. I don't have off the top of my head how many intersections are equipped with UPS, but you're right. When traffic signals got converted from bulbs, incandescent bulbs, to LEDs, the lifespan of a battery backup went up considerably. And the typical length of a battery backup for a signal is usually between 4 to 7 hours, depending on the amount of equipment that battery backup system is feeding.
Thanks for that.
Sure.
Ariel?
Coming back to the hawk lights, I think there were statistics presented in an earlier meeting about some research that had been done about like compliance with hawk lights, and I don't remember what those numbers were, so apologies if we've been over this before, but like, do we have a sense for how compliant drivers are with both all those stages of the hawk light, particularly like the red light, but also the flashing red? Because my anecdotal experience as a pedestrian and a driver is that drivers do not understand the flashing red light stage. They just treat it as a green light.
Yes. Good question. I don't have any hard data on compliance with the hawk indications. And you bring up a very valid point, and I see it driving around town all the time, is drivers react differently at the hawks. Some will stop at the solid red, and then they will do it correctly. And if there's no one in the crosswalk, they'll proceed on the flashing. I've seen some drivers that kind of go slow and just creep through the intersection without stopping. And I see a fair amount that if that red light is on, either solid or flashing, they will stop and they will not move. So, but to answer your question, I don't have any hard numbers on compliance.
I'm sorry, as a follow-up, you know, probably want to understand if there is a compliance problem and if it's causing safety issues, but wonder if there's an opportunity for some sort of education campaign, you know, in the same vein as, like, you know, educating pedestrians about safe behaviors, is there, and drivers about not texting while driving. Is there something about, you know, how a hawk light works that could be helpful in terms of driver education out there?
No, that's a very good point. And I know that our public information officer always does blurbs about various things, just like you say, pedestrian safety. So this could be a very good topic for a quick little blurb to drivers about HOCR operation. So no, that's a very good point.
Riley?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I agree with that. I think that would be great. I hear a lot from people who they see nobody stops or like people blow through it. I actually haven't seen that myself. I've seen pretty good compliance at the Hawks, but I hear from others that they find them scary anyway. But my question was actually about people stopping, the lights are flashing red, the person is walking across, these streets are like 100 feet wide. They pass the middle island, or they pass the middle end, so they're on the other lanes that go the other direction. And then people are like, they get itchy feet and they're like, I'm gonna go, even though the person hasn't totally cleared the zebra crossing, but they've crossed the direction that people are parked in. And I'm wondering if that is when you say they have to wait for them to clear, like they are violating the law by proceeding at that moment. I don't like when people do that because all the other drivers feel like they can start moving, but what
Right.
is the law say on that?
The way that I've always understood it is it's that pedestrian in the crosswalk, irregardless of if there's a center median, like you say,
Yeah.
like on Grant, where there's a median between eastbound and westbound traffic. So I've always understood it if is that it's the pedestrian in the crosswalk. It doesn't matter if they're past the median or not.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. So that pretty much finishes my presentation. If anyone else has any questions.
Thanks so much, Hal. Any other questions, comments?
It's Jennifer. I'm having trouble managing my hand up.
Sure.
What's going on with the Hockett Treat and Glen? I noticed that all of a sudden there's a box that appeared, and that's the solar one that's always malfunctioning.
So, good question. The city of Tucson, we started with two solar HOCR crossings, that being one of them. We've had continual issues with that solar equipment. So what we're in right now is we're in the process of converting that solar hawk to a regular electric power supplied hawk.
Thank you.
Marshall, Miranda, James.
Yeah, just a question about the cameras for the signal performance detection stuff. Are those regularly monitored by employees for the see to see if they're still in alignment, that type of thing?
No. Short answer, no. Usually, I mean, we don't have the manpower to watch them. So basically, what we do is when we get a call that something's not working, that's when we go out and fix something. And typically, it's the alignment, yes, or sometimes the whole detection camera goes bad. But
Yeah.
yeah, that's when we go out and address it.
Thanks.
My question's kind of related to Marshall's. I was just curious if you have a generalized like picture you can provide of like the condition of the infrastructure and the signals like on a citywide level, like how much in need of maintenance to like unclog things and fix alignment there is. I was also curious to know if like the number of signals we have are sort of like meeting whatever best practices there might be for sort of the amount of intersections we have. And then I had just a more generalized question about The priorities that are being used to calculate the timing of signals, if it's primarily about moving vehicles through or if pedestrian safety is included in that calculation.
Okay, so what was your first two questions was dealing about basically the signal equipment and needing upgrades, that sort of thing?
Yeah, like how's it all doing right now?
Right. And the short answer is, I say everything can always be improved. But like I said at the very beginning, where this presentation is going to hopefully meld into smart mobility presentation, and it's, let me back up a second. There's traffic engineering and there's smart mobility. Smart mobility is really the group that does all the maintenance and maintaining all of this infrastructure, the traffic signals. So I can get an answer for you, but I bet that this presentation that smart mobility is going to be giving you is going to address that exact issue about where the equipment stands and where we need to be moving towards. So that's should be coming, but that's a good question about, you know, where's all this infrastructure stand currently? So that was a good question. What was the third question?
It had to do with sort of like the inputs or the sort of priorities that you're giving to different like factors when decisions are being made about traffic signals and timing and things like, you know, whether it's going to be a hybrid or permissive or protected, things like that. And
right.
Or and how, if at all, pedestrian safety is a part of that calculation.
Right. So pedestrian safety, which goes back to the timing of the signal, those just like for the vehicle indications, yellow and the all red, those times are calculated and they're set. Those times can't be modified. Same thing with the crosswalk times. The don't walk, like I said earlier, is the minimum. They can't be modified down. They can always be modified up or longer times. But when we're timing like green times for the main street versus the side street, you know, there's flexibility there of allotting times in different amounts. So about the pedestrian safety, that's not one of the factors that have allowed to be changed. That answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, let's take James's question, and then we'll probably need to move on to the next topic.
I also had a question about the detection system. I guess two questions. One was just simple, as I'm wondering if the images recognize bicycles, like if the algorithms ping someone's there, if they're only in a car or if bicycles also apply. And then just a second follow-up was just the decision to not save the images, is that a law or is that just standard practice? Because then you're going to have to hire someone to manage that data, and that has infrastructure associated with it also.
Right. Let me answer your second question first. The choice or not to record the images. Yes, that would be a huge database that we would have to store. And really, that data input from the cameras, the camera detection systems, is just for the operation of the traffic signal. It's just telling the signal controller, you know, there's someone waiting in that left turn, bring up that left turn arrow. So that's all it's used for, is it's just a cycling basis of telling the signal controller the vehicles at the intersection. So no, we don't store it. And yeah, it'd be a huge database. Your first question about detection and does it pick up bicycles and motorcycles? Video detection has evolved over the years. And yes, to answer your question, it will detect a bicycle and it will detect a motorcycle. And so, yeah, there's been big strides in video detection technology in the last few years. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Hal. This was very interesting. Hopefully the council got a lot of your questions answered related to traffic signals since you requested this. So thank you, Hal.
No
The
problem.
next topic is Small Project 411 funding report by Ryan.
Hi, thanks, Tani. And thanks, Hal, for your great presentation. Appreciate it. Yeah, give me one sec to get that queued up. Things always pop up on the screens. I don't expect them to. Okay. All right. So this is just going to be a very brief update on the improvements that were recently made at Mountain Avenue and Helen Street. This is the first project that falls under the small dollar projects authorization that CSEC gave approval to a few months back. So I'll just dive right into it. So there's a long history of requests for improvements at Mountain and Helen. There's just a very large amount of bicycle and pedestrian traffic crossing Mountain, as well as walking along Mountain. In addition to a lot of vehicle traffic, there's multiple parking garages and parking lots along Helen Street as well. So you've just got a lot of users, very high mode share of people walking and biking. And it's just been kind of a chaotic intersection. So there's been some work to kind of try to find some solutions in the past. There was a road safety assessment in 2013. There was another study that was done in 2016. There is not an unusual crash history in this location, but it's there's significant comfort issues and safety concerns that result from this mix of college students walking, biking, driving through the area. So there was work done by what's called a JOC, a job order contract. So that's where we hire a firm to do the construction and sometimes design as well as part of a package. We don't bid it out. We don't necessarily, although sometimes we do. So the cost came to just under $27,000, and the goal was really improve safety for all users, reduce exposure of vulnerable users to vehicles, and enhance their visibility. So this was, you can see this sort of very rough design. This is not exactly what it looks like if this were a sort of a larger project with more involved design. You would see sort of more precise design, but this is sort of more conceptual. You can see dimensions drawn on there that don't necessarily match what's actually, what's actually on the aerial there. You've got these sort of very rough crosswalk and bike crossing markings that are really just meant to sort of provide the idea, while the jock actually determines the details in construction. So this consists of new striping that enhances visibility of vulnerable users. You've got the high visibility crosswalks at all four legs of the intersection. You've got these green markings for bikes along Mountain Avenue to kind of increase the visibility there. You've also got these green boxes on the approach for in the bike lane for all four directions. Additionally, there are some flex posts on each approach for bike riders that prevents vehicles from encroaching into the bike lane or the waiting area for people. On Helen, it provides a little more protection, and you just don't have to worry about vehicles coming up behind you, essentially. And then also an important piece of this is signage to restrict left turns from a Helen onto Mountain. That this is one of those movements that creates backup and creates sort of unpredictable behavior that we were trying to reduce. So you can see here there's a picture of the finished product. Construction was done over the summer to minimize disruption while the U of A was not in session. Some adjustments had to be made after the fact. There were some flex posts that had to be moved. But the work is now complete. Staff has done some early observations, finding improved compliance with the turn restrictions, as well as with yielding to pedestrians. Now that it's been in place for a while and people have had a chance to get used to it, we'll be doing some further observations as well. So that's all I got. It's just a very brief update just to kind of fill you in on how that money is being spent. And if anybody has any questions, please feel free to ask. And Hal, I don't know if you if you were involved with this, if you can answer any questions as well.
Marshall.
Was this the first project funded underneath its framework? I don't know if you mentioned that.
Yes, it's the first project that's been completed under that framework, yes.
Exciting.
Yeah, exciting. Anyone else? So you can all try to make sure you go through that intersection and experience it.
Yeah, it's very different, and it's interesting because, you know, I mean, the traffic control, other than the left turn restrictions, you know, hasn't changed, but a lot of drivers seem to sort of treat it more like it's like a yield approach on Mountain. I mean, there's just a lot. I think because there's a lot going on, there's the in-street pedestrian signs, which were already in place previously, but then you've got the flex posts and everything is kind of narrowing things up and kind of making the, you know, the pedestrian space more visible and kind of shrinking the vehicle space. And it really seems to encourage more yielding that wasn't occurring before for pedestrians, you know, waiting to cross Mountain Avenue.
James?
Yeah, I've actually been approached specifically about this intersection a couple times. The comment that was made to me, and I don't really know how to verify its truthfulness, was that the compliance for pedestrians is definitely up, that the walking through the intersections is feels safer, but somehow the compliance for bikes has gone down. If someone's coming up on Allen and is trying to turn onto Mountain, they have found that the cars are just flying through the mountainside and they don't stop really for, like, if a bike comes up and is trying to take the left to get onto Mountain to go north, they've found that compliance seems to have gone down a little bit. I don't know if that's real, I personally have been approached about this for bikers feels like still very unsafe, just because the lack of a stop or yield or something for the mountain cars. And, you know, a lot of these bikes are happening, you know, at quitting time, 5 p.m. And so there's an extra speed boost to the cars getting home. And so I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, no, that's thing. We appreciate the feedback on that. Yeah, we can look into that. See if there's anything else we can do.
Okay, very good. Why don't we move to your next topic, Ryan? Silverbill Prop 411
All
project.
right. This one I'm excited about. I mean, it's all exciting, but this one I think is pretty cool. Oh, okay. Well, here. So that I'll hold on the sort of title screen here because I think this is a cool side by side. You know, this project was conceived of and, you know, you all approved funding for it after construction had already started, after waterline work had already begun and Silverbill was torn up. So we didn't really have the ability to get before pictures, before any kind of before data like speed measurements or anything like that, because we hadn't, you know, this project didn't exist essentially before the construction work started. So there's just, you can see a street view on the left and a similar view on the right of one section. And just to see it's kind of the difference and the transformation there. So just as a quick recap of a few of the things that I presented on when I did the funding request back in March, but the goals are improve safety for all users, improve walkability and accessibility, calm traffic, provide a low stress bike facility, and to leverage repaving work for strategic improvements, considering that we already had a contractor doing asphalt and concrete and other improvements out there. Just a reminder, this is on Silver Bell Road from St. Mary's Road to Congress Street. So this includes the section in front of St. Mary's Hospital, as well as the area around Anklam where Tumamoc Hill is. Just a reminder, this project, components of this project came from Move Tucson, and this was a tier one ranked project, so highest priority. There was a road safety assessment that was done last year, I believe, as well as some neighborhood input that helped sort of shape the scope of the project. And then we used the street design guide and guidance from the Federal Highway Administration to help us determine some of the details of the improvements. And then, it was just an opportunity, as I mentioned, because it was a Proposition 101 funded repaving project that was removing and reconstructing the roadbed, as well as some curb ramps and other things. So this was an opportunity to layer in other improvements while that construction was going on. So the improvements that were funded were protected bike lanes, a rectangular rapid flash beacon crossing, sidewalk gap fill on the east side of the street to provide continuous sidewalk on the east side. The west side, unfortunately, was not feasible within the scope of this project because essentially it's an embankment. It would have been a it, that is a much, much larger multi-million dollar project, essentially. And then the last piece is pedestrian refuge islands to make crossing the street easier. So just a real quick rundown. I mentioned already that the concept and approval occurred after construction had already started. One of the stipulations was we couldn't delay the repaving work, so we had to kind of work within the timeline and of the repaving project. We couldn't do anything that was going to slow down or stop the repaving work. We did add work that ultimately I think added to the construction time a little bit, but it didn't create any significant delay for the repaving work, and that was key. One thing that was kind of interesting, which is new to me, but not a new concept, is we didn't do design for the sidewalks and most of the ramps that were done. They were done by something that's called standard details. So the City of Tucson and Pima Association of Governments have these, have drawings of typical improvements, be they curb ramps, be they, typical sidewalks, driveways, traffic circles, all kinds of things. And the idea is that, you don't always need to have a custom design for everything that you build. In a lot of cases, you can, unless you have unusual circumstances, unless you've got, topography issues or drainage or utility issues that you're having to work around. In some cases, you can use these standard designs and essentially have the contractor use those and sort of fit them to, the work that they're doing on the ground. So that allowed us to do the sidewalk and get that done on the timeline that the contractor was already doing the sidewalk or the yeah the they were doing some sidewalk repair as well as curb ramps. So that allowed us to sign up to kind of just like piggyback on the other concrete work that they were already doing. And then the stuff that was designed was the layout of the protected bike lanes, the refuge islands, and the RRFB. So just some quick details on the protected bike lanes. For most of the street, the width of the bike lanes is 6.5 feet plus a 4 foot buffer. Just for reference, most bike lanes in Tucson on major streets are between 5 and 6 feet with no buffer. So this is providing about double the total, space, including the buffer. The project consists of 108 precast curb segments. These are 1 foot by I think 8 foot long concrete that is pre-manufactured and essentially bolted into place in the field. We also used what are called K71 delineators or tubular markers. Those are this is like the third project that's actually used these in the city, but the first one that's actually used them in this way. The other ones have been for much, much smaller, like traffic calming purposes. So, you know, we try to branch out and test different kinds of devices. You may be familiar with the Zeekla Zebras on Main Avenue, but you know, we are looking for you know, better ways to provide bike lane separation, you know, accounting for things like drainage and budget and, you know, that we have to work within. So, you know, what we're hoping is that these are, you know, sort of more visible, have a more substantial, you know, look to them than typical flexible delineators, and that the combination of these delineators with the precast curb provides, you know, a pretty continuous, I guess, vertical separation in the bike lanes. And then just to mention, we bought a bunch of spares because, you know, we don't know how these are going to hold up. We really wanted to make sure that while, you know, while we're testing these, and this is a test, we're, you know, we're not looking to deploy these everywhere right now until we kind of see how it all performs. But we bought a bunch of extras just to make sure that, you know, we're not caught flat-footed, because we don't keep these things in stock typically, like we would with regular flex posts or other devices that are more common on our streets. The sidewalk, and as I mentioned, you know, we didn't go through design. That necessitated some things about the sidewalk. One is that the width ended up being 5 feet. We wouldn't be able to do 6 feet in a lot of the stretch of the road without, you know, running into complications. Similarly and related, you know, there were some areas where we might have been able to set back the sidewalk a little bit from the roadway by a few feet. Unfortunately, there was a lot of the road that we couldn't do that. There's landscaping and other things that we were going to run into. You can see there, you've got, I think it's like a, you know, water valve or something there. So, you know, because we weren't able to do a custom design, and because it, you know, with field fitting with standard details, you know, you generally have to be pretty consistent and kind of, you know, pick a design and go with it. And we decided that was acceptable in large part because the protected bike lanes provide much greater separation from vehicle traffic. So even though, you know, you're on a sidewalk that's attached to the curb, that doesn't have, you know, a buffer, you've still got that 10 and a half feet of bike lane and buffer between you and vehicle traffic. The RFB, that's in front of St. Mary's Hospital and right next to the bus stops right there. It also provides safe crossing between the hospital and the bus stops and the Safeway shopping center. The location was based on the observed behavior. A lot of people are already crossing there and public input that we heard. Also, while we were in the design process, we realized we needed to add a street light. There was already one, I believe, on the east side of the street, but you know, we want to provide enhanced illumination for, you know, for these kinds of crossings beyond, you know, the typical roadway lighting. So we added that street light as well. And then we had four pedestrian refuge islands. One of them is paired with the rectangular rapid flash beacon. And we placed them where we could to provide, other than the one at the RFB, we placed them to largely to provide access to the sidewalk on the east side of the street for people who are on the west side and vice versa. So, you know, at a few of the streets that go through on the west side of the street, we provided those refuge islands there. So you don't have to walk along the west side of Silver Bell in order to make that two-stage crossing. And it reduced the crossing distance. Instead of having to walk 56 feet across in one shot, you have two crossings of 22 feet each. So much reduced, much, much simpler crossing experience at all of those locations. And here's a little recap of what we estimated the costs at. These were very, very rough costs that were based on sort of very extremely high level estimates for, you know, the square footage cost for sidewalks, curb ramps, all that stuff. And the total cost came in actually remarkably close. So, there's some variation. The sidewalks ended up being a little bit more. The RFB ended up being a little bit less. The protected bike lanes ended up being significantly more because we were able to determine that we could add those precast curb segments. Initially, we thought that drainage was going to preclude that. There is cross drainage coming off of the hill on the west side of Silver Bell. But our design consultant did a little drainage analysis and was able to determine that we could do those. So that increased the cost a little bit, but it provides, more substantial protection. There's also approximately $20,000 in design costs. We don't have exact numbers for some of these things because we're still kind of teasing it all out because it was all done so quickly because we were having, the design consultant and the contractor do work that was both related to the repaving as well as related to safety improvements. We haven't fully disentangled everything, but we're expecting the grand total to come in at about 630,000. But some of these numbers might shift a little bit in the end, but this is pretty close to the final accounting. And that is my presentation. Anybody have any questions?
Thanks.
Questions, and then I have an ask.
Yes. James.
Yes, thanks, Ryan. I was at the Anklam and Silver Bell intersection recently, and I noticed that if you're coming down Anklam to take a right to get onto Silver Bell, there used to be a dedicated right-hand turn lane for the cars, and it seems like that's now been blocked off. And I was just wondering if that was always the plan, or did something happen, or I was
Yeah,
just,
you know, th yeah, that was actually something that was added to the design. So this project, there was a finished, I'm using air quotes here, a finished design for the striping and everything a few years ago, and actually the closure of that right turn slip lane on Anklam was included as part of that, as well as the improvements to the pedestrian crossing there and the enlarged island there. I believe the reason that it wasn't completely filled in was because of drainage, because there is a wash that can overflow through that intersection and in front of the hospital. So I think that's the reason why it's not like, concrete permanent change there. But yeah, the idea there was that, that allowed people to make a high speed turn from Anklam onto Silver Bell. And it's not desirable, and the traffic volumes did not warrant that, dedicated right turn lane. So that was taken out. So yeah, I forgot to mention that partly because that all happened a while back, or it was included in the plans well before all of this.
Thanks.
So, Ryan, did you want to talk about the walk and talk?
I want to just comment on it.
Go ahead.
Well, first, it's pretty close to where I live in a common commuting, sort of corridor for us on bikes, and it's amazing to have this. It's just like bike with my kids and feel very comfortable. Like it's just such a different experience to what it was before. So, really grateful that the funding got approved and that this project went in. And I hope it's, first of many of these, and we'll see more extensions of these going in. I mean, we have, when we come out to Congress, it's still, you feel like, okay, well, now I'm back to a little bit of exposure, there, but it's still good. And I know people who live up Silver Bell a little further north, and they're like, oh my gosh, I wish it extended, further north so that we could hop on there and just comfortably ride all the way to the Mercado or the streetcar or whatever. Hopefully this is the beginning of much more of this type of improvement. The cars, I think I've mentioned this at some point somewhere, I don't know where it was, but even before the bollards went in and the protection on the bike lanes, just the narrowing of the travel lanes for cars, the cars were so much slower already without any of the like hardscape going in. It was amazing. So whoever said the studies show narrower travel lanes slow down traffic, I really witnessed it there. I mean, the curves probably help. But I'll also say though that it's still a little sketchy, still sketchy, straight sketchy at that curved intersection where you come from Anklam onto Silver Bell. So if you're coming from Tumamoc, or better yet, if you're going north on Silver Bell, you want to turn left to go to Tumamoc. That's still a scary place to you know, you got to merge on a bike over to the middle turn lane, and then you have cars coming south that want to cut, you know, into the turn lane as they're coming around that curve. So it's still a little bit scary there. Maybe there's something that can be done in the future at that intersection. You know, you still have to go pretty far out of your way to cross somewhere else, like if you're walking, you know, unless you're gonna wait and just sort of
Yeah, I mean,
frogger across.
you know, we one of the things that we have heard is people wanted a crossing at Anklam, but because the road bends there, you just don't have the visibility there. People are coming around that curve, and there's just
Yeah.
same kind of visibility that you really need for a crossing like that. So that's the reason we didn't put a crossing at Anklam. I totally am understanding of the desire for a crossing right there. It would be very convenient. But it is something that we considered. And yeah, at least within the scope of this project, weren't able to.
Yeah, I know, yeah. But it's on the whole, it's really, really, really great.
Yeah. Thank you. I really appreciate it. You know, this is I don't think I've hidden that I'm excited about this project. I think it's really cool. I think it's an example of, you know, what we can do when we you know, add some money to a paving project and, you know, use the street design guide as a guide. I mean, the widths of the roadway and the, you know, and the treatments that, or the widths of the lanes and the treatments that we use, those, you know, those came out of the street design guide. You know, the lane widths that you talked about that slow down traffic. I mean, that is the preferred lane width for a street like this, 10-foot lanes on Silver Bell. Previously, they were something like 15. They were really, really wide before. So yeah, I mean, you know, unfortunately, as I mentioned, we didn't get before and after speed measurements, but it does seem like traffic is moving slower there.
Oh,
And, sorry, go ahead.
one last question. The bollards, are they like, what happens if a car hits one of those? Is it just a piece of plastic kind of bolted and looks substantial, but is not much, or? Just kind of curious what that looks
Correct. Yeah. So they are flexible, like they are a flexible plastic. So they will deform and then stand back up if they're struck. You can
like.
actually like if you want to walk up to one, you can smush it with your foot. So, you know, as far as
Wow.
actually like running into
Don't
the
tell
wall,
anyone
that's not going to
that.
stop a
Yeah.
vehicle. The precast curb has more of a sort of physical deterrent, but you know the idea is that the combination of the sort of the more
Yeah.
visibility, the higher visibility of the posts with the precast curb
Yeah,
relatively
no,
low spacing.
yeah. Together, I think they work well. I think the if people hit one of those concrete, whatever they're called, they're not going to want to hit those again. So,
Yeah.
okay. Thanks. Sorry, I don't want to
No,
take a
thank
bunch
you.
of time on it.
Appreciate the input. Any other questions or comments before we move on?
Doesn't look like it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Oh yeah, okay. So, if anybody would like to go out and actually see this in action and you know, do a little walk and talk, I'm looking at holding one on Saturday, November 2nd, or on November 9th. And so I guess we're looking for here. I'm going to stop sharing because I can't see a bunch of stuff right now. I'm looking to hold a walk and talk so that you can all, you know, experience it and you know, ask additional questions, kind of see how the road is functioning and now with these changes. So are we able to do like a poll, Tani or Colleen, do you know?
Well, I have a poll for the December meeting, but we can add it. Why don't you just discuss for a minute the time of
Yes.
day you prefer?
So we'd be looking to do either, you know, the morning of either those Saturdays, November 2nd, November 9th, or potentially like mid-afternoon, not too late, not running into people's evening plans, but not in the middle of the day either. So, you know, maybe like 4 o'clock.
So it would be Saturday, November 2nd.
Or the
So what
9th.
are you saying?
Yeah, so November 2nd or November 9th and either AM or PM.
Be like morning or mid-afternoon. What do people consider mid-afternoon? Like 2?
Yeah, I'm open to input. Right now those days are open for me.
3 o'clock.
3 o'clock.
1 second. Poll coming.
What about the morning time? It's a Saturday, so, and weather's nicer now, so we don't have to get up super early. Is like
10 o'clock.
10? 10?
Yeah.
So 10 or 3. Seem to be the options.
10 a.m. and 3 p.m. And then this is, and it's clear where you're answering that you would be going, right? Everybody's
to Silver
clear.
Bell.
Yeah, the plan is to meet at Silver Bell in Anklam.
And Ryan, like what, like it, about how long do you think for what you're envisioning, like an hour?
Probably an hour, probably no more. I mean, okay. Really just be, yeah. I mean, we would walk down the street. We talk about it. We look at, you know, the crossings, bike lanes, RRFB. I think an hour at the most. If anybody wants to linger and, you know, talk more, I'm happy to do that. But yeah, I would try to keep it no more than that.
So the second date thing took that we're going to talk about right now, in fact, because the poll is all one poll, is December. Co-chairs and facilitation team and staff would like to propose an in-person meeting like last year. So the options, obviously, the last week in December is the winter holidays. So we're looking at 2 December dates, same evening time, in person. So in both of these, click all the dates that would work for you. Like when you respond to a doodle, not just your preferred time. And I'm just going to launch this right now. So you have those are the 2 questions. You see it? Oh, yeah. First ones are coming in.
And just to clarify, this December, sorry, 1 second, this December meeting would take the place of the November and regularly scheduled December meetings because those both hit the holiday times. Sorry, Roger.
I'm sorry. Can't get to raise my hand because the poll's in the middle of the screen. but I just want to make a comment. I can't be at either any of the second or the ninth. Work and travel are in the way, but so should I just answer like which day I want the December?
Yeah, if you can't, just don't answer at all if you can't do any dates. But December, okay. Yeah, just do that one.
All right, thanks.
Oh, look, and there's a mystery question 3 you can ignore. And this is really for members. I should have specified that. And core staff, such as Ryan.
Ryan's good with everything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Ely.
So we might be there, Tani.
Raise you your hand if you still need a second. All right, so we've got 1 more vote for December 4th. Is there anyone here that couldn't do December 4th? Member.
I'll be traveling on that day, but I should be back in time.
Okay. And then, go ahead.
I have a school event that evening. So actually I have a school event both evenings, but I can miss the one on the 11th, but I can't miss the one on the 4th.
Okay.
All right. Jill did email me and said that she could do either date, but she'd prefer the 4th. So it sounds like she could do either one. But if it's
all right, so it sounds like we should just go ahead with the 4th, since maybe more people can't do the 11th. The walk and talk looks like afternoon is preferred equally on those 2 days.
So either day is...
Well, I mean, Colleen and I are going to be gone the second in the afternoon.
Okay.
So I don't know. Let's circle back on this.
Okay.
Since we can
discuss it afterwards. And yeah, once we figure out a date, I'll send out an email with an invite.
Perfect. Oh, I should have shared the results with you. There you are. Quick.
Cool.
All right. So we want to move on to the CSCC hub. 2 minutes each. IOAC, Jim's not here. Anyone else for presenting IOAC?
No, not tonight.
Park Tucson, Jill's not here. Anyone else representing? All the parking people are gone tonight for their meeting. The TTAC, Riley.
I don't have any updates. Trying to think of what we went through. We just went through some ridership numbers and some budget numbers, and it's like nothing to update. So we can just move on, unless anyone has questions about it.
Okay, any questions for Riley? Bicycle Advisory Committee, James?
Yeah, so last meeting, we decided we're going to try to start this, a new sort of project or initiative. So this comes from a common complaint of bicycle network not being contiguous at many places. You know, you're riding in a bike lane, then all of a sudden it stops, which causes, obviously, it's just frustrating, but also a lot of safety issues. So we're trying to go. PAG has a nice map of the what is supposed to be the complete bicycle network, although we've noticed some errors in it. And we're going to each place where there's like a break in the network and trying to find a workaround. So this is not like proposing that the city builds bicycle infrastructure there. This is more if you can, you know, a block previous, if you can transfer to a side street and then, you know, somehow get around to connect to the other side. Our goal is to present to the city this sort of list, and maybe we could at least get like a green stripe on this on the reroute, or maybe some signage. The goal here is to obviously have a more contiguous network, but also in a way that is affordable and that the city might actually do, instead of just saying please build better bicycle network. Although we obviously stand by that, it doesn't seem likely to happen. And so this is a way to suggest short-term improvements that would go a long way for those who are biking as a part of commuting to and from their job, because that's where the breaks in the network really, really seem to matter. So yeah, we'll see how it goes and how it's received. We did hear some feedback that they are interested in this information. If we could compile this list of all the places and the suggestions, it might cut some time out of the solution. So that was the main takeaway for me that seems relevant for this group.
Very good. Any comments or questions for James? Thanks very much. Cody, Zach is not here. Anyone else able to speak for the Cody? Okay, so then we'll move into personal complete streets experiential opportunity for the month. So the last one, it was actually we were on deck for this one the last two times, I believe. Visit a small business. Notice relationship of business to street. Extra credit if you get there not in a car. And Ryan had some additional questions. Like, does the business have seating or adjacent to a sidewalk? Is the business close to the street or is it set far back? What's good about it? What could be better? What is it like to access the business without a car? These are thought questions for the for your individual little field trips to small businesses. So it seemed like some of you at least had actually done this. So we want to just open it up for any sharing if you had done this.
I can kick it off Marshall, if you go first.
Oh yeah, I was just gonna say, so I live in the Duffy neighborhood, around the corner at 5th and Rosemont, a deli. So that's pretty walkable from my house, or we're able to walk there. We have a sidewalk on Rosemont on the east side of the street. There's no sidewalk on the west side, which I think is severely lacking for some people who want to use who walk up and down Rosemont. And this is something that Zach brought up in the last meeting. I think it's still important to reiterate. We do have a lot of sidewalks that are needing repair due to heating and the expanding joints cause the sidewalks to basically buckle upwards. But overall, I think it's a good experience to be able to walk around town to restaurants and businesses that are within walking distance.
Great. Miranda?
I live just north of U of A campus, and then I work in Armory Park, so I kind of bike down University and then down Fourth Avenue, so it's really easy for me to visit local small businesses. And lately, I've particularly been enjoying stopping by the co-op to get small groceries, because their east entrance is really bicycle friendly and welcoming. And I think that the improvements that they did as part of the renovation are just really like hospitable to that kind of like, you know, sort of multimodal transit, having places to sit that you can sit at and you don't necessarily have to buy anything. Like, it just feels really, like I want more of that in Tucson.
Nice. Others? Ryan, you were going to share something. Jennifer?
Well, Ryan can go if he wants to. So,
no, you go first. Then Ryan.
First.
All right. I live in Country Glen, which is Country Club in Glen. And I'm north of, north of Grant, right? So Grant and Tucson Boulevard. So one side is where Culinary dropped out, and across the street is Postino and Snooze. And that used to be a strip mall. And when they built those two buildings together, the Postino and Snooze, they're really close to the street. I think they built probably with awareness of the street widening that will eventually happen, maybe after I'm gone. But it comes right up to the street. And the Snooze has like a patio that you can be out, and they can cover it and close it up. And then same thing with Postino. There's a patio. The patio is on the parking lot, and it doesn't have a lot of parking. And you can actually walk over there. Once again, you do have to walk down the sidewalks down Tucson Boulevard, which are lacking. It's walkable. It's easy to walk. And the problem there on Tucson Boulevard and Grant is, though, that people will just jump out into the street and not use the crosswalks or the hawks down the street. So, but that is there. So it's a good place.
Great. Roger.
I ride my e-bike now on errands to lots of small businesses. I got it because it makes it a lot easier in the hot weather to do errands, other than on a regular bike. But I go to Barrio Bread, and the frustrating thing is I live east of the Randolph Golf Course, and so I have to go on a major street, you know, and luckily around the park there's the bike lane that goes, if you go on 22nd, it's pretty noisy, but or you can go on Broadway. But if you go on Broadway, you have to cut back down through the Colonia Solana neighborhood, unless you want to go up onto Broadway. So it's interesting because, you know, they've been talking about putting a cut through in the golf course that would go across the middle. That would make access to businesses both east and west of the Randolph a lot easier, more direct, you know, because you have to go around to get to these businesses over there. Natural Grocers, there's a wine tasting place, Bisbee, you know, breakfast and bread. We're all there. So it'd be nice to have it. I went looking at the golf course the other night, and the golfers were up in arms about watching their golf course. So we'll see what happens. You know, in the meantime, I usually go north on along Broadway and come back down through the neighborhood to get to Barrio Bread, because it just seems more, it's prettier, you know, than going on 22nd.
Right. Okay, good. Thanks for sharing that. This is all getting noted. One last sharing, or should we move on, Ryan? Because we only have 7 minutes left.
Let's move on. If you don't mind, yeah. I've got a number of updates I'd like to share.
Go for it.
All right. We're moving on to wrap up.
Yep.
All right. And now I've lost the window that had my notes. Okay. All right. Just some project and other updates related to transportation and specifically the city. The Stone Avenue Complete Street Project, which mostly consists of a protected bike lane from Alameda to Ochoa Street, as it could be complete by the end of November. It's already complete from Alameda to Pennington. That was done to get it done before Tucson Meet Yourself. The Roger Road Pedestrian Safety Project from Romero to Oracle, that has started construction. That's a Prop 407 funded project. That's expected to be complete by April. The Marianne Cleveland Way Shared Use Path should be complete in just a few weeks by mid-November. And so that's another Prop 407 project. The 9th Avenue Castro, 9th, 7th Street, and 5th Street Bike Boulevards should start construction in November as well. The Valencia Road project from Cold Houghton also starting construction in November. The 5th and 6th Street projects, which include waterline work, repaving, pedestrian safety, that work should begin by the end of the year. I think it's currently looking like November, but who knows if that'll slip, but it should start by the end of the year. That project is going to be kind of going in different phases. So there's going to be waterline work happening at the same time as some of the pedestrian safety improvements. We have one contractor doing everything and kind of trying to optimize what they're doing and when and where. The short-term improvements to Country Club Road that I mentioned at the last meeting, those should be installed by the end of the year. That'll include night speed limits, additional speed limit signs, buffered bike lanes with flex posts and tactile feedback, intended to slow vehicle traffic and reduce unsafe passing, as well as radar speed feedback signs. There are several collector streets that are repaved soon, including several east side streets that are part of some Prop 407 funded bike boulevards. Those are getting striping enhancements in advance of the other improvements. There's going to be a public outreach event for those bike boulevard projects this Saturday at Jesse Owens Park from 8 to 10. So if you're interested, here, I'll drop the website for the projects in the chat here if anybody wants to check that out. Included in those collector streets that are being repaved, Tucson Boulevard and Elm Street, we've been working on a striping plan to improve the bike lanes on Tucson Boulevard and make some other safety improvements that we can do within the scope of striping improvements. It's not going to be a giant transformative thing like, you know, Silver Bell, but it should be a bit better biking experience. And then last but not least, Ciclovia is on this Sunday from 9 to 3. If you've been, I'm sure you know how you feel about it. If you haven't been, you should definitely check it out. You can show up, you can walk, you can bike, you can rollerblade, you can ride a bike that has a cow skeleton welded to it. It's a great event. So if you haven't been to it, I highly encourage you to go. The route is from downtown to South Tucson. And I will drop.
Did you say Saturday or Sunday?
Sunday. Sorry.
Sunday, 9 to 3.
Sunday from 9 to 3. And those are all the updates that I have. Yeah, Patrick is out, Jim is out, so those are the DTM updates.
Okay, so we have 3 minutes left. We want to get for the December meeting, which will be in person, as we've mentioned, if there are any topic ideas that you all have that are especially useful to be in person to discuss, does anything come to mind? Where we could look at maps, you can interact with each other in different ways. Anything come to mind? Okay. Any final comments from anyone? In other words, we thought we would end early, and indeed we have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Tani. Thank you, Ryan.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you all.
Thank you. I'll think of ideas.
Wait, did we officially end the meeting? Did I miss that?
Oh, wait, we have to do the thing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead, Marshall.
Oh, yeah. I move to adjourn the October meeting of the Complete Streets Coordinating Council.
And I second.
Thank goodness. Okay. Enjoy the rest of your week, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.